good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon, taking your calls if you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith. We welcome you to call in and raise those questions for conversation. And you can also call if you have a different viewpoint from the host and want to talk about that. The number to call is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. And our first caller today was, I think, the last caller we had on Friday, Art from Manhattan, New York. And I was so glad that you called back, Art.
Because I'm so glad for you to take me back. Thank you.
Yes. I mean, I felt so badly because we started talking and then the show ended. And I thought, wow, I thought I had a couple more minutes on the clock. But anyway, I felt terrible because you're in kind of a hard situation and I really wanted to address it. You want to restate it for our listeners?
Yeah, you bet. I'm having a challenge with my wife. I'm trying to avoid divorce. It's an abusive relationship, and I'm getting abused quite a bit. And currently, she's encouraging my sons to verbally abuse me and curse at me when I ask them to do any household chores. They're 16 and 18. What I'd like to ask is, one, if there's anywhere in your archives where you discuss the story of Noah, Ham, and the curse of Canaan. And if you could just spend a minute or two to overview that story so my sons, who will listen to this later, is so they can learn the ramifications of their reprehensible behavior, because I believe it's my responsibility to continue to remind them of the serious consequences of their behavior. Thank you.
Yeah, well, there definitely are serious consequences of your behavior, of their behavior, because to disrespect parents is to greatly offend God. In fact, the reason that Jesus, I think, introduced God to us as the Father, and that's something that the Jews of his time didn't usually do. They didn't usually refer to God as the Father. But Jesus did all the time, and he taught us to think of God as Father, is because of the reverence that children are to have for the Father. And, of course, because of the love and attention and affection that the Father gives to his children, which indebts children. I mean, children have no idea how much they're indebted to their parents. Unfortunately, sometimes they don't care. If they don't care, they're really wicked people. But if they do care, but they don't know, then they need to be informed. The story that you mentioned in the ninth chapter of Genesis is a strange one, because in it, Canaan receives a curse from Noah. Now, Canaan was not one of the sons of Noah. He's a grandson of Noah. He's a son of Ham. And in the story, it was after the flood. Noah planted a vineyard, and then when the time came that they made the wine and so forth, he drank too much and got drunk. And he was in his tent, laying on his bed, and he was in an indisposed, let's put it that way. It says he was naked. We don't know if he was totally naked or what, but the point is he didn't know it. He was in his own tent. He was drunk, and he was in a position that if anyone walked in there, it'd be rather embarrassing, and although he was too drunk to know it. Anyway, one of his sons walked into the tent, not knowing his father was like that, and when he saw it, he didn't do anything. He didn't cover him up or anything. This is Ham. And he went out and told his other two brothers about it. We're not told anything more about what he did, but it's obvious that what he did was he didn't cover his father's shameful situation, which he could have. I mean, when Ham discovered his father in that situation, he could have thrown a blanket over him and walked out and never said a word about it, you know. Instead, he left him in that condition and went out to essentially to gossip about it to his brothers. He told the world about it. Of course, the world only included those eight people in those days, but it was basically, you know, dishonoring his father to let others who didn't already know realize what a dishonorable situation he was in. And one of the other two brothers, actually, Shem and Japheth, when they heard this, they put a garment over their shoulders and walked backward into the tent so they wouldn't see him. They knew where his bed was, so they walked over there and they threw the garment down over him, and then they walked out so that they didn't see him in that condition, because it would be considered to be very shameful to be seen in that condition. And they honored their father by making sure that he wouldn't be the more embarrassed by having been seen by them. So that's what happened. So the two older sons actually showed respect to their father, even though he was not in the most respectable condition at the time. They still respected him as their dad, and they covered him up. And the younger son, Ham, had gossiped about him. Now, the Bible says that when Noah woke up, he knew what Ham had done. Now, I want to say this. There are some people who are going to tell you that what happened there was a sexual thing. It was not. They take the fact that there's an idiom in the Hebrew that you find in Leviticus and some places where to see somebody's nakedness is to actually have sex with them. But the Bible doesn't talk about that really being the case, that that happened. If that had happened, then there would have been worse things would have occurred. But Ham did not receive a curse, actually. His son did. Canaan did. When Noah woke up, he pronounced a curse on Canaan. Now, the big question is, why did Canaan get the curse and not Ham? And what's it all about? Well, Canaan was the one who gave rise to the Canaanites, who inhabited the land of Canaan and before the Jews came in, or the Israel came and conquered it. And they were under the curse of God because they're very wicked. I mean, there weren't Canaanites yet when this happened, but it eventually happened, and God knew it would happen, and Noah was able to prophesy about it, that they're going to be cursed, and they're going to become servants of servants. Now, this was an utterance given on the occasion of what Ham had done, although it doesn't say that this is because of what Ham had done. I mean, in other words, it doesn't say that Canaan is going to be cursed because of what Ham did. In all likelihood, Canaan was cursed because of what the Canaanites did. But because they came from Ham, this disrespect for his father that Ham had, I think was seen as a portent of the way some of his offspring would be. If he didn't respect his father, he's going to have some very disreputable offspring too, especially through his son Canaan. And the curse came on the Canaanites, who were, in Joshua's day, commanded to be wiped out. Now, the curse that came on Canaan doesn't say an awful lot about what Ham did, although it was the occasion of Ham doing it that caused the curse to be uttered on this occasion. But the main thing here is that Ham, obviously displeased his father, displeased God, and whether it was as a result of this or unrelated to this, his children became cursed by God. The point I would make is that when a couple has children, they allow into their private lives people who will be witnesses of their life for the rest of their lives, and who have a great control, in a sense, over their reputation. Think of how many movie stars have rotten children who write up the full tell-all novels about their parents and all the evil, wrong things their parents did. Because their parents are famous, they can sell them and make money, speaking rotten things about their parents. Rather than, if they were respectful children and recognized how much they owe their parents, they would want to protect their parents' reputation, cover them up like Shem and Japheth did with Noah. They knew about it, but they didn't want to publicize it. They wanted to cover that up, which is a respectful thing to do to your parents. It's such an ingrateful thing for children to mistreat their parents, or even to disrespect them, or even to gossip about them, both their friends, because, first of all, children have no idea the sacrifices parents have made. Parents, by the way, not only pay a lot of money to raise children for 18 years, but they give up their own freedom for 18 years, which otherwise might be the best years of their lives in other ways. A person could do a lot of selfish things in those times that they can't do when they're raising kids. And they do this on purpose. I mean, they choose to raise children because they love children. They love their children anyway. But in bringing children into your life, you're also bringing people into your life who's going to see you at your worst. Because everybody has a worse side. Everybody does. There's nobody who would like for the world to know everything they've ever said or done. And many people are able to behave well when they're out in the public, but their weaker moments often happen at home because they're with their families around so many hours a day. And so kids get to see the worst side of their parents. And if they want to go out and, speak it to the world, they're really betraying a trust. Children should understand that their parents, first of all, were given to them by God. And, if your mom or your dad is a a pimp or a drug addict or a prostitute or, you know, a murderer or something like that, I can see that'd be somewhat difficult to respect somebody who lives so disrespectfully, so dishonorably. But most kids have parents who they just disagree with or who they resent because they put restrictions on them or something like that, not because their parents ever did anything bad, not because the kids have a right to have more liberty. They don't. Kids don't have any more right to, you know, to have more liberty than their parents give them while they're in their parents' house, while they're dependent on their parents. If they move out and they're supporting themselves, they should still respect their parents and be thankful for what's been done for them by their parents for the past 18, 20 years, whatever it is. But they don't have to necessarily obey their parents while they're out of the house. But in the house, they're getting their rent, they're getting their food, they're getting protection, they're getting their medical, they're getting their clothes, they're getting probably transportation. And you know, if they turn on the person who's providing these things, it's just being a rotten person. Frankly, it's just being a rotten person. I say that as somebody who wasn't all that nice to my parents during a few years of my teenage years. Probably from the time I was about 15 till I was about maybe 16. I don't know. You know, I didn't like being restricted by my parents, but a lot of people go through that. But I'm glad I got over it because it was really rotten. It's a very rotten thing.
Would it be non-Christian? I have the 18-year-old who doesn't do anything. We just had a storm up here. He hasn't cleaned the yard. I mean, I'm working, you know, just 12 hours a day, and he's just not contributing anything to the household. He doesn't work.
Who pays for his cell phone? Who pays for his cell phone?
His mother, my wife, who, again, I try to take it away, and again, so my question, would it be unchristlike to have him leave the house? He's 18. He doesn't contribute anything to the household.
No, he's definitely able to. He's old enough to make it on his own. I left home when I was 17. My parents didn't throw me out. I wanted to be on my own. You know, back in my generation, people really wanted to grow up and be adults and become independent of their parents. I don't understand anyone who doesn't want to be, but he's definitely old enough. He may not be mature enough. But he'll mature fast if he goes out there and has to work and provide for
himself. But would it be unchristlike to have him evicted? I mean, if he's not doing anything, he's not contributing to any chores.
Yeah. I mean, if you tell him to do things, you're his dad, and he's in your home, is he not?
Correct.
Okay. So you when it comes to adults in your home, whether they're related or not, if they don't do what you want done in your home, then they should go out and find another place to live, and you have every right to do that. It's hard to do that because you feel like, well, I want them to be my friends. They'll resent me. You don't need your kids to be your friends. You need your kids to respect you. I'll tell you, they might be angry for a while, but if they ever grow up, they'll appreciate you. I remember a guy who came to one of my schools. He's a hippie guy who was kind of a rebellious drug-using kid. Then he became a Christian, and he came to our school, and he says, you know, I had two dads. I had my natural dad, and I had a stepdad. He said, I hated my dad because he wouldn't let me smoke dope. He wouldn't let me, you know, sleep with girls in the house. He wouldn't let me do this stuff. I hated him. He said, but my stepdad, I really liked because he'd smoke dope with me, you know, and he had no rules. But he says, now that I'm grown up, I have no respect for my stepdad. And I really respect my dad because he took the hard position. I mean, kids don't realize how hard it is for parents to risk losing their children's love because parents love their children. And by saying the hard thing, by doing the thing you know will displease your children, even though you know it's the right thing to do, you take the risk of losing their love. And they don't realize how hard that is to do. But if you're tough, you'll do it because you should. It's good for them. And they will find out later that it's good for them. The longer they stay immature, and frankly, it sounds like if they think staying in your home for free when they're 18 years old is mature, then they don't know what mature is. That they're just being, you know, juvenile. The longer they stay immature, the harder it'll be for them ever to become thankful for what you've done, to take responsibility for themselves. I mean, I do think if he's not going to cooperate with you, if he's not recognizing your leadership of the home, then he doesn't belong in the home there. And as hard as that is, I think you got to do that. Now, your wife, you say, is supporting the boys in this behavior, right?
Yes.
And she doesn't respect you either. So, but you're still living together.
Yes, we're living under the same roof. She refuses to get a job, a full-time job, and she just gives them everything that they want, you know, unbridled internet access.
Well, wait. How does she, if she doesn't have a job, how does she buy them stuff?
Well, she has a part-time job.
Oh, okay. So she uses her money to do that
and
stuff.
And then
okay.
I learned that she stole money from me and a lot of other things. So she's, it's a challenge. I feel like Job sometimes.
Yeah. Well, you know, we might want to talk off the air because we've got a lot of people waiting now. But anyway, I think we've talked about your situation. I don't think your sons will appreciate much of what I said, but what I said is true.
God bless you, and thank you so much.
All right. I'm very sorry. By the way, another guy wrote to me, emailed me after I talked to you last week and said he was in a similar situation. He wouldn't mind talking to you. So I don't know if you want to email me with your address or phone number or something. I can pass it along to him if you'd like.
Oh, you bet. I will, certainly.
Okay. I'm Steve at thenarrowpath.com. If you email me, just say let this guy have my email or my phone number.
I will. You bet. Thank you, Steve.
All right.
God bless you. Thank you.
Okay, you too. Bye now. All right. Mike from Albany, Oregon. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Good to hear from you, Mike.
Thanks. It's good to hear from you, Steve. I'm a little bit hesitant to bring up my questions just because it's about some parts of the Law of Moses that critics like to bring up.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not a Bible critic. But, you know, I understand the culture is really different and God's working within that culture. But I'm kind of wondering what to think about this. So in Deuteronomy 22, verse 13 through 21, it's the law about where if a man falsely accuses his new wife of having no evidence of being a virgin,
uh-huh.
and if the parents call him out on that, but they can't provide proof that she was, then she gets stoned. And then if they can provide proof, then he gets whipped and has to pay a really large fine and then can never divorce her. And the two questions I have with that is, do you know, would she be allowed to divorce him if she wanted after that? You know, if he was the one that was lying and that all came out, would she be allowed to divorce him if she didn't want to stay with him?
I don't know of any case in the Old Testament where the law allows a woman to divorce her husband. Now, in the New Testament, women and men have exactly the same rights. Paul said the husband has no right over his own body, but his wife does. A wife has no power over her own body, but her husband does. The husband and wife are both in the same situation. Likewise, later on in 1 Corinthians 7, Paul said that if an unbelieving spouse departs from a believing spouse, the brother or sister is not in bondage in such case. So, you know, whether it's a man or a woman, they got the same freedom in that situation. I don't know of any law in the Old Testament that mentions women divorcing their husbands, but I'm not sure that that means they couldn't. Because Jesus did give a teaching where he said he not only forbade a man to divorce his wife without proper grounds, but he said, or if a woman divorces her husband, which sounds like that was something that at least maybe the society was allowing. I don't know if Moses' law did or not. But yeah, I mean, that's a hard law. Some of the laws are very hard, you know. And the idea here is if she had... if she was not a virgin when she married him and she was passing herself off as a virgin, then there had been neglect of another law that should have been taken care of earlier. Because if a man sleeps with a virgin, which in this case someone had before she married her husband, someone else had slept with her. If a man sleeps with a virgin under the law, they had to get married. Unless, of course, the girl's father would not permit it. In which case, she could marry someone else, but the other person would certainly know that he's marrying a woman who's not a virgin. In a situation where a man thinks he's marrying a virgin, and she's willing to pass herself off as one, she's committing fraud as well as other things, and that was considerably more serious in that society than it would be in ours.
Right. Well, the other question I had, too, is it sounds like the way it's worded, that severe penalty only happens if the parents call the husband out on it and say he's telling a lie, but they can't back it up. So it doesn't sound like the man could just accuse his wife of that. It sounds like he would have to accuse that. Then the parents would have to say, no, you're making a false accusation. Here's the evidence. And then there is no evidence.
A lot of these laws go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask about the evidence because, you know, we know now, I don't know if they knew this anciently, but, you know, it's not very reliable evidence, what they're asking for, you know, this.
Right. There are exceptions, definitely. Yeah.
And it's not reliable both ways. Like, it'd be really easy to falsify, and it would also be, you know, it's easy for that not to happen, even if she is a virgin. So
yeah,
I was wondering, what do you make of God using evidence that's so unreliable to prove something that has such major consequences either way?
You know, these laws are written so briefly, it's not as if there's never any wiggle room in them. That's just, I think that was left to the courts to decide, or for the priest to decide. You mm-hmm. know, I mean, a lot of times these laws are given in great brevity. I mean, even the only law in the Old Testament about divorce, for example, which is Deuteronomy 24, verses 1 through 4, it says if a man marries a woman and finds some uncleanness in her, then he can give her a writing of a divorce. Well, what is uncleanness? The rabbis had all kinds of opinions about what that is. Mm-hmm. It's like the law gives a general, you know, broad category. And then I think it was left to the wise and the priests and the, you know, the courts and so forth to work out applications. I would imagine there'd be lots of cases where the courts would let somebody off because of various things. You know, the evidence of virginity in those societies was usually, of course, a bloody bedsheet. But you're right. Sometimes a woman who is a virgin can't produce a bloody bedsheet because of something else. I mean, sometimes a very active young girl can have the same damage done to her hymen as if she had had sex, even when she hasn't. However, in those societies, you know, it's not like women were out playing sports or riding horses and doing things like that. So I think it'd be very much more unusual for a woman to not have the bloody show. But the thing is, I really don't know that people would carry these out very often. I think that judges would have to make some decisions about the fairness of a given case due to evidence. So, you know, you never read of any son being stoned to death in Israel's history for cursing his father and mother. There's a law about it, you know, and there's a lot of these things where, you know, the death penalty is there, but you never read of it ever being executed. Not that it never was. It might have at times, but it doesn't look like they always carried things out like that. I mean, for example, there was the law of circumcision for the whole generation that came out of Egypt didn't circumcise their children. So, you know, the fact that these laws are on the books, they either neglected them or in some cases they may have recognized mitigating factors. When you just read the laws, it looks really severe. But actually, the Bible indicates that the law of God is very merciful and very just and so forth. And it's just that you have to make application in a just manner, I think. And there would be no doubt many times, maybe most times, that this would not end up in anyone's death.
Well, so when I read through the law of Moses, I mean, is it fairly safe to say that if it seems very out of character for, you know, for example, it seems really harsh towards the women, but not very harsh to the guy. But Christ was, I mean, his mother Mary knew before anyone else that she was having a Messiah. He, the woman at the well, I think, was the first person he revealed in so much detail who he was. You know, he's treating women with all this extra respect. And then I'll see things in the Old Testament that seem, even the women in the Old Testament, there's a lot of strong women. God's commanding Abraham to listen to Sarah and do what she says.
Abigail, the wise woman, yeah.
So see that, but so when I look at the law of Moses and something seems off, is it maybe safe to assume that there's something I'm not getting from the culture?
That's what I would always assume. I mean, obviously, you read the laws of Moses, a lot of them go right across our grain. And part of it, we have to say, well, how much is our grain off kilter? How much are we the products of our culture? You know, we sometimes say, well, these people are the products of their own culture. Well, I'm sure they were in some measure, but who's to say that we're not the ones who are more off kilter because of our culture? You know, our culture isn't really the greatest culture in the world. We could have some off things too, but I always assume that if God commanded something and it doesn't feel right to me, that he knew something about it I didn't. And probably the people who received the laws knew some things about it that I didn't too. You know, I just trust God like a child that he doesn't mm-hmm. do anything wrong. And these laws were the most humane laws, you know, known to man in ancient times. So God is very humane, but there were death penalties for things. But like I say, yeah. they weren't always carried out. Even murder, you mm-hmm. could sometimes, if you accidentally murdered someone, you could run to a city of refuge and not have to face the penalty.
Well, these things had to be adjudicated. That it wasn't always...
Yeah, David was forgiven. Yeah, David was forgiven by God for his murder and adultery. So we can see that God is quick to forgive, but you need to have a legal code, and it's got to have some teeth, too. I mean, but mm-hmm. exceptions can be made at times. Hey, Mike, I need to take a break here, but I appreciate your call, brother.
Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for joining us. You're listening to The Narrow Path. We have another half hour. We just want to let you know at this time that The Narrow Path is listener-supported. If you'd like to help us stay on the air, we pay for the radio time. You can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Also, our website is loaded with resources, and everything there is free. You can also donate from there if you wish to. That's at thenarrowpath.com. I'll be back in 30 seconds. Stay tuned.
Small is the gate and narrow is the path that leads to life. We're proud to welcome you to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Steve has nothing to sell you today, but everything to give you. When today's radio show is over, we invite you to visit thenarrowpath.com, where you'll find topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and the archives of all the radio shows. Study, learn, and enjoy. We thank you for supporting the listener-supported Narrow Path with Steve Gregg.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for another half hour. We're taking your calls. If you have questions you'd like to raise for conversation about the Bible and the Christian faith, or if you have a different view from the host and would like to bring that up, feel free to give me a call. The number is, as always, 844-484-5737. Again, that is 844-484-5737. 5737. Our next caller today is Marty from Spokane, Washington. Marty, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. My question for you today, Steve, is what application, if any, for today do you see in Jeremiah chapter 23?
Jeremiah 23? Yeah. Do you have it in front of you?
I know it pretty well.
Okay, I'll look it up here. I don't have it memorized. Well, there's a prophecy about the Messiah here. Is that what you're thinking of, or are you talking about the later part of the chapter, in the early part?
Well, yeah, I'm kind of looking at the chastisement of
false prophets,
stealing all mm-hmm. the words, and I just see such a similarity to what's going on today in not correcting the people and, you know, letting them think they're on good standing with God when they're actually committing evil.
Well, yeah, Israel had a real problem with false prophets because the Israelites were the only people in the world who worshipped Yahweh, the true God. All other nations worshipped false gods, and all these other gods had their prophets too. There are prophets of Baal and prophets of Moloch and prophets of Chemosh and all these other false gods, and it was very tempting for either Israel themselves or for people on the outside who want to come in and pervert Israel to come and pretend to be speaking from God, and they're not really speaking from Yahweh at all, and they would lead people, of course, away from the laws of God, away from the things that God said he wanted Israel to do. Now, there was a sword of Damocles hanging over Israel. If they would disobey and worship other gods, there was a threat given to them in the law that God would have to disperse them and destroy their nation. And so it was a life and death thing for the nation to not be led astray by these false prophets. And so once in a while, you'll have some teaching against false prophets. You had Jeremiah 23 in the latter part of the chapter is pretty strong about that. False prophets actually were, according to Deuteronomy, supposed to be stoned to death. It was like a capital crime to lead people astray in the name of Yahweh. But you're wondering how that might apply today, perhaps to preachers who lead people astray. Are you thinking more of cults, or are you thinking of pastors of churches that are just not really faithfully preaching the word? What do you have in mind?
I guess it's hard for me to narrow it. But I was just basically thinking how much I hear people quoting, you know, a so-called prophet or pointing to this one and then starting entire movements around, you know, maybe somebody that's supposed to prophetic ministry.
People are much more gullible than you would think. You would think people would be discerning and careful. Because, I mean, especially when you know how many cults there are that were started by false prophets and how many people, even in churches who call themselves prophets, have prophesied falsely, and how easy it would be for anyone who's unscrupulous to say, hey, I got a word from God, here's what he said, and to try to draw a crowd. Oh, you've got to follow me, I'm the new Messiah, or I'm the new leader of God's cutting-edge movement or whatever. I mean, it's so easy for someone to fake that. You would imagine that thinking people would be careful about following people like that. I mean, when my Mormon friends have come to me and said, you know, well, Joseph Smith is a prophet, I just ask, okay, well, I don't think he is, but can you give me some reasons that I should think he is? What evidence has he given that he's a prophet? Of course, he started Mormonism. And they say, well, he wrote the Book of Mormon. I say, well, that alone would give me evidence he's not a prophet. But, I mean, even if the Book of Mormon is as perfect as they think, writing a great book doesn't mean you're a prophet of God. There's a lot of great authors who've written great books who aren't even believers in God. So, I mean, people just take the slimmest evidence or none at all to follow somebody. And that was true in Israel also, apparently. Now, in Deuteronomy 13, God said, even if a prophet comes along and gives you signs and wonders, in other words, they do something miraculous, he said, if they're leading you to go against Yahweh, you better not follow him because God is testing you to see if you love him or not. Now, when people go off the wrong way with a false prophet, and he hasn't even given them any reasons to believe in him, they really are disloyal to Yahweh. So the presence of false teachers is a test to people of whether they're going to be lovers of truth or not. If somebody comes and says, you know, God gave me a word for you, and by the way, many people have, and on a few occasions, I think they were right. There's been a few times people gave me a word that they said that it was from God. It would appear to me that it was, but most of the time not. But, I just think, okay, well, you think that's a word from God for me. I'll hear you, but I'll proceed as if I hadn't heard it, unless there's some other compelling reason to believe it. You know, I mean, just because someone says they heard something from God, I've seen too many people who think they've heard something from God and they just speak from their own, like Jeremiah says, from their own spirit, he says. Now, I don't believe, you know, we're not in the church going to be killing anyone for being a false prophet, because the church is not authorized to kill people. We don't kill our murderers in the church. We don't kill our adulterers. But we do disfellowship them. What a state would do with a criminal would be some physical punishment. What the church as a spiritual nation does is a spiritual punishment. We disfellowship, we kick them out, and we say, listen, until you repent, you can't really have access to the people here because you're a danger to them. So to me, excommunication is sort of the Christian church's alternative to capital punishment. It's more merciful because a person who's been excommunicated can repent and come back and be forgiven. A person who's been executed in the electric chair, they're not going to get another chance to come back. Anyway, we do definitely have false prophets today. Peter said there would be. Jesus said there would be. There are false prophets. John in 1 John chapter 4 said many false prophets have gone out into the world. So the church has always had had to have its radar up for the presence of false prophets. There's plenty of them around. I appreciate your call. Let's talk to Todd from Pittsburgh. Todd, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. First, I just want to say I'll be in prayer for that first caller that called in today. That was very moving. My question is about I was going to say it was about the Antichrist and Revelation, just so I can hear a bunch of 1,000 people groaning into their radios right now, but maybe they'll groan into my question. My question.
I turned the mic off so you can't hear me groan.
Yeah, okay. Genesis 2, specifically Genesis 2 verses 18 through chapter 3, 1 with the serpent. And I guess the problem I have with this section, I guess, is trying to make sense of how the woman in the story comes away any other way than sort of like maybe a little denigrated. She ends up winning the gold medal at the end by becoming the helper for Adam, as it will. But it's only after God has created all these other animals in verse 20, I guess it is, verse 20, to help to see if one of the animals, the livestock or you know the birds of the air, are suitable helpers for him. And I guess my first question is, the serpent, wouldn't the serpent have been one of the animals created that I guess would have gotten passed over for the job?
I mean, Genesis 3:1 mentions that he was one of the beasts of the field which the Lord made.
Yes, exactly. And do you think that could have been a motive? I know it's not stated for maybe why the serpent maybe betrayed Eve, because he sort of maybe gets the medal, the silver medal, doesn't get the gold at the end, you know, isn't the one that's really chosen to be Adam's helper.
You know, I have to say that I don't know what motive the serpent, I think the serpent was an animal, and I believe it was inhabited by Satan. And I think what the serpent did was really Satan's doing, of course. Now, whatever made Satan want to be an enemy of God, we are never told. But it seems to me like Satan may have been made for that purpose. That is, he is made for the purpose of testing the royal seed. You know, Adam and Eve were made to be the rulers of the world. That's what it says. God said, let us make man and let us give them dominion over everything. So Adam and Eve were the royal seed to take over the world. And yet they were unvetted. You know, you don't want to give somebody the throne if you've never vetted them. You don't know who they are. So they had to be tested to see if they'd be loyal to God. And I think the devil was there, the serpent in that form, was there to test them, to test their loyalty. And I think that God wanted them tested. So I think that's, I don't know, but that God might have made the devil to have this role. I honestly don't know. The Bible doesn't tell us. But sometimes people do try to figure out what was the devil's motivation for, you know, opposing God. And some say, well, because he wanted to be worshipped and God, you know, wouldn't let him be worshipped and God alone was allowed to be worshipped. You know, the Mormons, I think, say that it's because God chose Jesus instead of Lucifer to be our Redeemer. And so he was angry about that. I have heard people suggest that the devil was angry because God made man in his own image, and that the devil was jealous of that or something. But we're not really, I mean, these are all things that people come up with because they want to know an answer. I guess we're not supposed to know the answer because we're not really told. So I can't be sure. I can't tell you exactly, you know, if that could be a motive. But I guess we could put that on the list of possibilities. I wouldn't rule that out. Okay, let's talk to Susan from Dallas, Texas. Susan, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling. Hi.
Good afternoon.
Hello. Hello, Susan? Maybe she got cut off. Going once, going twice. Susan, are you there? All right, Susan's not there. Okay. Let's talk to Mark from Vancouver, B.C. Mark, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, Steve, as you know, Romans 14 indicates that obviously the Sabbath day is something that's optional, and obviously to insist that it has to be Saturday or it has to be Sunday is obviously wrong. But there is that option to keep a one day above another, correct?
You say there is an obligation to keep one day above another?
No, I said an option. Like, obviously no obligation for sure. But there is the option. So in other words, there's no requirement, but there is an option, correct?
Of course, yeah.
Okay. Now, what I was going to say is, unlike that's the case, obviously, in for the Sabbath day in Romans 14. But clearly in Galatians 4, it seems Paul is saying, he says, I fear that you're turning to the weak and beggarly elements. You're observing days and months and
right.
years. So there it seems like he's saying there is no option to go beyond the weekly Sabbath to get into observing feasts and so on. It seems that he is definitely not giving any option for that kind of observance. Would you say that's so?
Yes, I would. Now, but I think you have to understand the difference between what he said to the Romans in chapter 14, what he said to the Galatians in chapter 4, verses 10 and 11. And that is that in Romans 14, I believe the church had perennial conflicts between the Jews and the Gentiles over the whole keeping of Sabbath and clean and unclean and things like that. There's plenty of evidence throughout the book of Romans that there was some, some mutual criticism between the Jews and Gentiles in the church. And so when he comes to chapter 14, that's already something that's come out, and he's saying, listen, some of you want to keep a holy day, some of you don't. Some of you want to eat a limited diet, some of you don't. Okay, fair enough. If you don't want to eat a limited diet, don't. If you do, do. If you want to keep a holy day, do. If you don't want to, don't. That's what he says. Now, essentially, I think what he's saying is the Jews in the church, of course, are the ones who are more inclined to keep Sabbath, as they always have. I mean, these were adult converts to Christianity. They were Jewish. They've been keeping Sabbath all their lives. And if they want to keep a day holy to God, well, I mean, there's no harm in doing so. Same thing if they want to keep a kosher diet. There's no harm in doing so. He says, go ahead. But the people who don't want to don't have to. I think what he's saying is probably mostly the Gentiles aren't interested in keeping those Jewish rules, but the Jews customarily had all their lives and probably were still wanting to do it. And Paul's saying, you're at liberty. You're at liberty. You Jews who want to do it, do it. You Gentiles who don't want to do it, don't do it. Now, when it comes to Galatians, these were Gentile churches. These were not Jewish Christians. And Judaizers had come from Jerusalem to tell them as Gentiles that they had to be circumcised and they had to keep the Jewish law, which would include, of course, Sabbath keeping and other festivals and all that stuff, and the Jewish dietary restrictions. Now, Paul was totally against that. He didn't mind if people who had always kept the Sabbath wanted to keep doing it because they had, you know, it's part of their culture. After they became Christians, there's no sin in taking a day off to meditate on God and read the scriptures. I mean, it couldn't hurt anyone to do that. But if someone was trying to put the Gentiles under obligations to keep the Jewish law, Paul was totally against that. He said that was compromising the gospel. He said that he wouldn't tolerate that for a moment, he said in Galatians. So there's a difference here between giving the Jewish Christians liberty to maintain some of their Jewish practices, if they wished, on the one hand, and on the other, in Galatians, imposing on the Gentiles anything like a requirement to keep any of the Jewish practices. That's what the difference was between those two cases. Okay, let's talk to John from Maryland. John, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, God bless you.
Thank you.
I don't know if you remember me. He came and visited my church last year. I'm so glad that I'm...
Oh, this is Junior, huh?
Yes, sir.
Oh, good to hear your voice again, yeah.
I'm glad you remember my name. So I have a question. I've been debating this with someone, and I feel like I use different many approaches, and I wanted to know your view. And it's on Genesis 6.
Okay.
And the question is, well, the first question is your view of did Satan fell from heaven? That's the first question. And the second question, two part, is who were the giants or the Nephilim? So that's my question.
All right. Well, on the first one, did Satan fall from heaven? In other words, was he an angel and he fell and became the devil? This is possible, but the Bible doesn't say so anywhere. This is a very traditional view. It's supported by the book of Enoch in the intertestamental period, and the Jews picked up on that idea apparently from there. And then some of the early Christians held it too, but the Bible doesn't teach it. So some of the early Christians believe that Satan had been an angel who fell, and almost all modern Christians believe that. It's just, and it could be true. I would not say it isn't true, but the Bible doesn't say it, so it's also possibly true that he was never an angel. I would never want to make a big issue of that with somebody if you're debating with someone, because I think the Bible's really silent on it. if it means more to them than it should, they're probably wanting to debate over Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28. If that's the case, then I mean, if people want to debate with me about those, I'm ready to debate them. But I don't have any skin in the game. I don't really care if Satan's a fallen angel or not. It's what he is now that matters, not whatever he used to be. So if Satan was made to be a tester, or if he was made as an angel and he became a tester, all that happened before any of us were here, and so it's really a matter of curiosity rather than a matter of importance. But if you're interested in like a thorough discussion of that, you mm-hmm. can go to my website at the topical lectures on spiritual warfare. Mm-hmm. I think it's the second lecture. It's called The Origin of Satan, and I go into Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28 and all the other verses that are sometimes used. The others are all in the New Testament, but none of them ever say that Satan is a fallen angel. So you can get those points from my lectures, which are free, of course, at the website under the Spiritual Warfare series. The second lecture is The Origin of Satan. As far as the Nephilim, or the giants in Genesis 6, there's essentially two views on that. One is that they are superhuman beings that are kind of hybrids between humans and fallen angels, which is perhaps what your friend is taking, that position. It's a very, very, very common position. That, too, was introduced in the Book of Enoch, and that also became part of Jewish lore, and some of the early church fathers believed it, too. So both these views, that Satan's a fallen angel and that the Nephilim were the half-breed human/demons, those originated, I believe, in about 200 years before Christ, certainly not taught in the Old Testament, which is where you'd expect it to be taught because that's where the stories are found. I mean, the Old Testament doesn't teach anything about that. Now, of course, the passage in Genesis 6 does say the sons of God married daughters of men, and they had children. But there's two things I would point out before we make that some kind of a proof that the Nephilim were half-breed angel humans. One is there's nothing in the Bible to suggest the necessity of seeing the sons of God as angels. The term sons of God is used in more than one way, and sometimes it does refer to angels in Job. Other times it doesn't. It refers to Israel when they are obedient, or to Christians. Now, beloved, now are we the sons of God, the children of God, John says. So sons of God can refer to angels or not. So that's an open question. Are the sons of God angels or are they men? The other question is, are the Nephilim the actual children of those marriages? It doesn't say so. What it says in Genesis 6 is there were Nephilim in the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God went into the daughters of men and children were born to them. Now, so it says there were Nephilim in the earth in those days, and also afterward, when these marriages took place, there were Nephilim. It doesn't say any of the Nephilim came from those marriages, and if they were around before those marriages, it's clear that you didn't have to have a supernatural father and a human mother to be one of the Nephilim. I personally believe the Nephilim were simply giants. Giant people. And there were races of giants. The Anakim were another race of giants. Of course, Goliath was a giant, but he had four brothers who were also giants, and they were all called sons of the giant. Their father was a giant, too. These would not be, in my opinion, Jack and the Beanstalk type giants. These would be giants like people maybe 10 feet tall, which would be glandular freaks, perhaps, The Nephilim, you ask my opinion, it can go either way on this. I mean, it could be the sons of God are angels, and they married women, and they had supernatural offspring. Or it could be the sons of God are not even a reference to angels. They're just people. And that the Nephilim are not the children of those marriages. It doesn't say they were. So there's room for more than one opinion about that. I personally favor the idea that the sons of God were human. And the Nephilim were not necessarily children of those marriages that we're just told there were very large people, bad large people in those days. So, and they continued to be there after the period of time when these marriages were taking place. That's actually how it's worded. So I'm inclined to think it that way.
Yeah, that's true. Well, Thank you. Thanks for your answer. Hope
John.
Get to visit us one day, someday.
Yeah, I hope so. I did get an email from you. I know I haven't been able to respond. You know, this COVID thing, I'm not traveling very much.
Yeah.
Right. All
no
right,
problem.
Brother. God bless you. We'll be in touch. Bye now. All right. And Deanna from Vancouver, BC, you get to be our last caller today. Welcome.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi. Yeah, it's a little hard to hear you. Anyway, I'm just calling about what you said about the devil. The devil wasn't created in by God. He was created as a good angel, and that's in Revelation 7 to 9.
You're thinking of Revelation 12, 7 to 9.
Or 12, right? 7, 9,
yeah.
Right?
Right. And, wait. Just let me stop you here before we go further.
Yeah.
Revelation 12 actually doesn't mention the devil ever being an angel.
No, it just says Michael and his angels fought against the dragon.
Right.
And then that was Lucifer. And
well, he's not called Lucifer.
Lucifer was jealous because they didn't include him in the plans. And
okay,
then let
me just say this.
Angels fought.
Yeah, just because we're running out of time.
Thrown down to the earth.
Okay. Because we're running out of time, I can't go into all of the scriptures about it, but I did recommend that.
Yeah, it's very hard to hear you. You're weak.
Okay, I'm sorry to be so weak. I haven't eaten much today. Let me see. Let me just say that, as I did to a previous caller, that if you want to see all those scriptures that you are alluding to expounded verse by verse, I have lectures where I do that. I'm very familiar with all the scriptures you're referring to. I will say this, the things that you've been told about those scriptures, which you're repeating to me, are not actually found in those scriptures. Lucifer, for example, in the Bible is never identified with Satan. There's only one reference to Lucifer in the Bible. It's only in the King James Bible because the modern translations translate Lucifer as the bright shining morning star, which is what the word means. And he's not identified with the devil in that passage or anywhere else because the word doesn't appear anywhere else in the Bible. So there's nothing in the Bible to identify Lucifer with Satan. The war in heaven between the dragon and his angels on the one hand and Michael and his angels on the other is indeed Michael and his angels are truly angels. The dragon's angels, we don't know. The word angel can mean messengers, but we don't know exactly who they are. They could be the demons. But the dragon himself is not said to be an angel. He's a dragon. You never find Satan ever referred to as an angel in the Bible. But I'm very sympathetic with your thoughts because I realize that we've all been taught that. I was taught that for many years too. And I'm not even saying it can't be true. It can be true that Satan is a fallen angel, but the Bible does not say so. And therefore we have to consider that there might be another option that could make as much sense biblically. So I'm not here to promote the idea that Satan isn't a fallen angel. I'm here. All I want to do is let you know what the Bible does and does not say about the subject. And it does not mention Satan being an angel anywhere in Scripture. I know that's surprising to people because in Ezekiel chapter 28, there's a reference to the king of Tyre who is compared with a cherubim. Cherub. He says, you are the anointed cherub that covers. And some people say, oh, that must be the devil because the cherub, that's not a human being, but it's a figure of speech. He says, you are a cherub in the Garden of Eden. Well, the devil was in the Garden of Eden, but he wasn't a cherub. He was a serpent. There was a cherub there that guarded the way to the tree of life, but he was separate from the serpent. So we need to be careful not to let our teachers just, you know, give us scriptures and say, this is what this means. I mean, we can if we want to, because it won't hurt anything to be wrong about this. But I'm the kind of person who likes to make sure, before I affirm something, that the Bible actually is going to say it and back me up. Because I don't want to say something silly and look goofy if someone says, where's that in the Bible? And I have to find out only then that it's not there. Thanks for joining us today. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. We are listener-supported. If you go to our website, you'll find all the lectures that are there. They're free. You can also see how to donate there at thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk again tomorrow. God bless.